And all that talk about what's the right time, the best time for various things got me thinking, when is the best time for a baseball playoff game? The League Championship Series get underway this evening in Los Angeles with the Philadelphia Phillies facing off against the Los Angeles Dodgers in the National League Championship Series. The game is set to start at 8:07 Eastern Time. That would be 5:07 in Los Angeles. In the past, Major League Baseball has been criticized for scheduling games that start too late for East Coast viewers, too late for kids to watch, and frankly too late for a lot of baby boomers to stay up for. And to help explain the league's scheduling decisions, we called on media reporter John Orand of the Sports Business Journal, who's on the line from his office in Northern Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert.
And how does Major League Baseball set the schedule for playoff games? What time the game should begin?
Well, baseball doesn't have an exact science about when to start the game, but they do have a little bit of a science. They have the ratings numbers that they get from Nielsen Media Research, and people on the East Coast would be really surprised to hear that the best times to start a game actually are right around 8:30, between 8:30 and 9 o'clock.
Part of the information here is that whereas there are two teams from Los Angeles in the playoffs, one in each league, more than two-thirds of the American people live in the Eastern and Central time zones combined, so that's where the people are.
Yeah, it's almost counterintuitive, actually. I'm looking at numbers that are a little bit dated. They're from the 2007 division series. If you take a look at the ratings, the later the games go, the higher, the more number of eyeballs they reach. In fact, the only demographic groups that show a drop-off the later they go are older viewers who are over 55 years old and younger viewers who are between 6 and 11.
I mean, it's what kids and boomers have in common, which is that those eyeballs get very bleary sometime around 11 o'clock at night.
Exactly. I mean, I have a 10-year-old son who hasn't been able to watch one pitch of one World Series game yet. It's something that living in the East Coast, I would love for a game to start earlier. But the networks in baseball, they need to reach as many people as they possibly can with their broadcast, because the Fox Network spends a ton of money on the World Series. So it wants to make sure that it sells the highest rate for advertisers.
But don't these professional sports leagues, it's not just Major League Baseball, don't they run the risk of not connecting with 10-year-olds all over the country if they can never get to see the big games, or certainly never the ends of the big games?
Well, I use my son as an example. He's 10 years old. He's never seen one pitch in the World Series, but he loves going to baseball games. If you go to a Sunday afternoon baseball game during the World Series, you see a ton of kids running around. It might not necessarily show up in the ratings, and they might not be watching at 11:30 when the game ends, but I don't think that there's really any evidence showing that the sport is skewing older as start times get later.
There is actually one game scheduled for 1 o'clock in the afternoon in the League Championship Playoff Series.
Yeah, which is unique. Fox has a Championship Series game that starts at 4 o'clock on the East Coast, and 1 o'clock locally in Anaheim, which is where people are going. So me and my son on the East Coast, we're ecstatic about it. We're going to be able to watch the entire game. I would imagine that people on the West Coast aren't too happy about that.
So. Or your son, if you lived in Los Angeles, would be in school at that time.
Exactly. So he'd come home to see the last couple of innings, I suppose. It is one of those things where the networks are almost in a no-win situation, no matter when they schedule it for. Given the time differences, they're certain to get just really get a bad time for it.
Well, John Orand, media reporter for the Sports Business Journal, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Michael Jackson's death in June put an end to his planned comeback tour, but his career continues.
This is it. Here I stand. I'm the light of the world. I feel grand. This love.
This is it. That's a Jackson song that was just released today. Michael Jackson isn't the only performer to have songs released after his death. Tupac Shakur, Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra, and many others have released whole albums of so-called new material. Well, that got us thinking about the lucrative market of licensing and managing the images and the work of dead celebrities. And there's no better person to turn to than Mark Rossler. His company, CMG Worldwide, handles publicity rights for dozens of celebrities who've died. And he joins us now from his office in Indianapolis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michelle. Nice to be on the program with you.
Apparently, there is a lot of unreleased Michael Jackson music out there. Is there some serious earning potential here?
Well, sure there is. I mean, what we've seen with Michael Jackson is something that we've seen in the past with the likes of Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, James Dean, and these are the fact that these legendary personalities have stood out over time, and they're going to be remembered not only for the next few years, but for the next few generations.
Now, Mr. Ressler, as I understand, you don't represent the Michael Jackson estate, but as you look at this career and the span of his career, what will be the challenges in trying to manage that portfolio?
Well, the immediate challenge is going to be to get your arms around everything that's out there, because he had such global appeal that there are things happening all over the world. I mean, there are 7 billion people in the world, and only 5% of those are in the United States. But there's another 95% of the world's population out there that needs to be addressed, that knows who Michael Jackson was, and I'm sure there's a lot going on.
You know, as we noted, there's a lot of unreleased Michael Jackson music out there. How do you balance the release in this and making sure that you don't give in to the impulse, I guess, to put as much of this out there as fast as possible to satisfy the public, or also balancing the interest in looking at this or listening to it carefully to make sure that you're not releasing songs that maybe weren't released for a reason?
I think in the case of Michael Jackson, it's well known that he was in a lot of financial debt at the time of his death. And because of that, I think his estate is very concerned about how they dig out of the debt and they provide for his family in the future. So I think what you see is a very concerted effort to maximize the financial revenue for the estate, not only so they can dig out of the financial hole that they were in, but so they can provide for his family.
Michael Jackson was a real perfectionist, and some of the music that was not released, as I understand, was not released because it didn't meet his standards. How do you balance the interest of getting music out there that the public might be interested in, but also remaining true to the artist's original desires?
I think that's why you need good management in a situation like this. Michael Jackson is the goose that lays the golden egg here, so he has to be protected as we move down the road now.
Mark Ressler is with CMG Worldwide, that's based in Indianapolis, Indiana. Mr. Ressler, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Michelle. My pleasure. This is it.
Mark Ressler was talking to us about handling the work of dead celebrities on a new song, as a new song was released from Michael Jackson, and that song is called This Is It. And this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today in Chicago, a small clump of Elvis Presley's hair was sold at auction for $15,000. Let me repeat that. Somebody paid $15,000 for a patch of Elvis's hair. And yesterday, in London, 12 single strands of Michael Jackson's hair were purchased for $2,000. Granted, they were pieces of Michael Jackson's singed hair, you know, from that 1984 incident when it caught on fire. Anyway, there's one man who had a hand in both of these hair milestones. His name's John Reznikoff, and he's believed to have the world's largest and most valuable collection of historic human hair. The Michael Jackson hair was from his collection, and he authenticated the Elvis hair. John Reznikoff joins us from Fairfield, Connecticut. Mr. Reznikoff, welcome.
Thank you, Guy.
So help me figure this out. What is the appeal of collecting hair, human hair?
It kind of is centered in Victorian tradition. And 100 years ago, if somebody famous came to town, let's say Robert E. Lee, you didn't ask for his autograph like you would a celebrity today. You asked for a little snippet of his hair.
And he would let you actually take scissors to his hair and cut it, or he would just pull it out?
Well, usually he might be with somebody who might have a knife or scissors, and he'd cut a little strand. And that's how a lot of the hair in my collection is preserved. Not all of it. Some of it has a little bit more macabre origins.
I read that in your collection that you have hair samples from Abraham Lincoln as well, Albert Einstein, Marilyn Monroe. How did you get these?
Well, the Abraham Lincoln hair is one that I'm very proud of. That is the actual lock. And again, this is a little bit macabre. It is the lock that cleared the wound the night of the assassination on April 14th, 1865. And it was obtained and passed down through the surgeon's hands and his son eventually, and held in a family for about 80, 90 years and ended up with me.
You also have some older historical figures. You've got Beethoven, I understand.
I do.
Napoleon?
Yes.
Ava Brown. This is a new acquisition.
Yes. For a long time, I didn't want to collect any bad people's hair. I wanted only people who positively affected history. And I think it was a little bit sour grapes because I was trying to buy a John Wilkes Booth lock of hair, and we couldn't get together on price. And I decided at that point that, and it was, I guess, self-serving, that I wasn't going to collect bad people. And that very lock of hair made its way to me about 6 or 7 years later. And then I said, well, you know, maybe I will collect some people who didn't exactly make the best impressions on history as well. Just a few.
So what do you say to people when they, you know, when they say, this is a little weird?
See, I am an autograph and document dealer by trade. That's what I do. And this is kind of a sideline. And we're a society of hero worshipers. We always want to be close to somebody who we admired or who we think about or who is important historically. And we're trophy collectors is what we are. So when you frame it in that way, it's not that strange.
Has anybody asked you if one day you could take the DNA samples from that hair? And, you know, you never know, right? The possibilities are endless, if you think in science fiction terms.
We're thinking alike, Guy, because I got to tell you that I've often referred to this as the Jurassic Park mentality. Could you imagine having a dinner party with all the great luminaries in history because you can take their DNA and clone it? I mean, what has happened in the last 10 years is pretty amazing. Do I realistically think this is going to happen in my lifetime? No.
But if it did, you can imagine that a lot of those people would come screaming at you saying, hey, what are you doing with my hair?
Undoubtedly.
John Reznikoff is a collector of celebrity hair. He joined us from Fairfield, Connecticut. Mr. Reznikoff, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
My guest, Seymour Stein, founded Sire Records and signed Madonna, the Ramones, and Talking Heads, launching their careers. Stein learned the record business at King Records, where founder Sid Nathan became his mentor. At Nathan's funeral, Stein was one of the pallbearers. When Nathan was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Seymour Stein was the presenter. Stein was only 14 when he met Sid Nathan. At the time, the young Stein was working at Billboard magazine. Billboard used to host listening sessions where record company owners would play their recordings and try to persuade Billboard to give them a good review. Stein met Sid Nathan at one of those sessions.
I remember that session, you know, like it was yesterday. And it was over 50 years ago. Sid was there and another record man was there as well. What I remember very clearly was there were a large amount of records to listen to. And the last two or three were on the Jubilee label. And one of the reporters said, I hear Jubilee Records is going out of business. Why should we even bother with these records? He said, I'm sure, you know, Sid is getting a little bored here. And Sid said, in the way he spoke, you know, he said, look, what if I wasn't here? Would you talk that way about me? Listen to these records. And so the person said, boy, Jerry Blaine, who is the owner of Jubilee Records, he said, he must be a good friend of yours. And he said, oh, no, I'm suing the son of a bitch. And he said, but what's right is right, you know. And one of the records actually became a hit. I can't remember. It might have been White Silver Sands by Don Rondo or someone like that.
So how did you get to work for Sid Nathan?
He invited me out to spend the summer with him. I was still in high school. I was 15. And I said, yeah, wow. And my parents were a bit, you know, my father was an Orthodox Jew, and, you know, I just didn't understand all of this. And I'd brought them up to Billboard. And an appointment was made, which I didn't talk to my parents for a couple of weeks. I was so embarrassed that they would, you know, question something that was so wonderful. And just as he walked into Sid's office, he put out my father's cheap cigar, and Sidney immediately reached into his pocket and gave him a Havana, which my father was not used to. And he had my father in his pocket. And he said, well, he said, Seymour here, he's got shellac in his veins. And what a compliment. It meant that, you know, I was a record man, you know, because shellac was the main ingredient in old 78s. And then he explained that to my father. He said, if you don't let him do what he wants to do, he's going to wind up doing nothing, and you'll have to buy him a newspaper route, because that's all he'll be good for. And this was April, and my parents rushed home, and when I got home, everything was packed. I wasn't supposed to leave till the end of June, when high school was up.
So how old were you when you went to work with Sid Nathan at King Records full-time?
Full-time. It was 1961, 62, so I would have been 19 or just turning 20.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that Sid Nathan did for you after you started working with him at King Records was tell you to change your name. Your real last name was?
Oh, I was born with the name Steinbiegel, Seymour Steinbiegel.
And what was wrong with that in Sid Nathan's eyes?
It was too long. And he kept asking me to change it, and I didn't want to hurt my father's feelings. My father was the eldest son, and both his brothers had changed their name, had shortened it. But he felt, out of respect to his father, he should keep it.
But you did change it.
Yes. Not everybody had phones at King Records. People shared phones, as much as three or four people could share a phone at one time. But there was a paging system, and the switchboard operator had one microphone, and Sid had the other one on his desk. And I was being paged. I had an incoming call. Seymour Steinbiegel, pick up the closest phone, Seymour Steinbiegel, there's a call. And she was repeating it over and over again. And all of a sudden, Sid's voice came on, and he said, oh, no, it's Stein or Biegel or back to New York. And I almost started to cry. I was so embarrassed. And I changed my name, and I'm very glad that I did.
So you got started at Billboard magazine. Do you ever miss the importance of the charts, the days when, like, top 40 really meant something?
I miss it a lot.
What do you miss about it?
I miss all the excitement. I mean, that's how I heard about Billboard. There was this disc jockey long before rock and roll, Martin Block.
WNEW in New York.
Yes.
Make-believe ballroom.
Exactly. It's make-believe ballroom time and free to everyone. Well, I would come back on Saturday mornings from the synagogue and have my radio sort of under the pillow so my father couldn't hear it when he came home, listening to Martin Block play the top 25 off of the Billboard chart. And later he started playing, in addition, the top 5 R&B and the top 5 country and western. And that's how I got introduced to Johnny Cash and Ray Price and Hank Williams on the one hand, and to some of the R&B records, to my idol, Fats Domino, as well. Radio was very important in the charts, and they played the Billboard charts. That was what Martin Block played off of, and that's how I knew to go up to Billboard.
So you miss it. You miss those days of the charts.
Sure do.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Seymour Stein, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Seymour Stein founded Sire Records and got his start at King Records with King's founder, Sid Nathan. The new book about King Records, King of the Queen City, was written by John Harley Fox. We want to thank Brian Powers for all his help with our show about King. He's the music librarian at the Public Library of Cincinnati and has done extensive research on King.